Our next speaker is, Rebecca Parker. Rebecca is the Research Services Librarian at Swinburne University of Technology. She helps manage the Swinburne Research Bank, an online collection of research produced at Swinburne designed to showcase and increase access to institutional research. She's also involved in Swinburne's online publishing activities. Rebecca is currently a member of the Advisory Group for the Australian Research Data Commons, the ARDC, a party infrastructure project, a collaborative project between ANZ and the National Library of Australia. The title of Rebecca's paper this afternoon is Accessible Openness, Repositioning Repositories for a Changing Landscape. Thanks, Rebecca.
All right, I'm a bit soft, so I'm just going to do this. Can everyone hear me now? Yep, excellent. Thanks.
I think it's the other one.
Oh,
is it? Yeah,
that
one records.
All right. It is too. Okay, excellent. So I was asked to talk to you today about the kinds of questions that you might receive from researchers about open access. Until a few weeks ago, they might have been really quite focused on repository management, but as Gavin's been talking about, that UK Finch report makes a difference. So I'm probably going to talk a lot more about the context for open access at the moment than running a repository per se. So it's been a big year for many things in 2012, as you can see. However, unfortunately, I think it might be remembered for this as well, the year that open access went mad. It started with this. Harvard said they couldn't afford the journal publishers' prices. If Harvard can't, who can? The Guardian also reported that subscriptions to journals and publishers cost about 10% of the basic operating costs of universities in UK. That is huge. Then we had the Research Works Act, which came out at about the same time as SOPA, which was the Privacy Act in the US. It contained provisions to prohibit open access mandates, like Gavin was talking about, for federally funded research. In particular, the National Institute of Health mandate, and medical researchers were quite concerned that this could cost patient lives. The campaign actually got bipartisan support in the Congress, which was unusual, but the cynics among us might say it was because Elsevier was donating large campaign costs on both sides. Many people signed the petition against it, and in the end, Elsevier actually withdrew their support for the act, citing concerns from journal authors, editors, and reviewers. I'm not also one of those people who has to speak out about publishers all the time, but I think it might be the first time I can think of where all of these groups, librarians, authors, editors, publishers, societies, banded together to make a change for open access. Then, of course, there was the Finch Report, which I like to think of as the Gold Finch Report, just because of the very heavy focus on gold that keeps appearing. So it's now been 10 years since the Berlin Declaration of Open Access, which Stephen Harnad talks about quite a lot. Since then, well, at that time, we really defined open access as the practice of providing unrestricted access via the internet to scholarly material, particularly journals, peer-reviewed journals. We've kind of widened the scope of what open access covers in the intermediary time, but it's probably also a good time after 10 years to look at what the pros and cons are and how much they've changed. For us, as librarians, it's a really easy cause open access to support. So we talked about how the books were chained to the desk. That was closed. Now we're really pro-open. So we're pro-equitable access to publicly funded research. Open access in journals can usually promise faster turnaround times than traditional publishing through large journals, which have a huge backlog that the editors have to get through. With open access journals, there's often quite simple reuse options, so use of Creative Commons licenses to make it clear what you can do with the material. I like to see open access as an alternative to scholarly publishing rather than a support for it or instead of it. I don't think it's quite that black and white. And we talk a lot to our researchers about the benefits of open access, meaning increased citation impact, because people can find their work more easily. There are also some downsides. Questionably, open access journals often have less impact in research than subscription journals, and this is partly because they're not indexed in things like the Science Citation Index and the Social Sciences Index from Web of Knowledge, which are the ones that pretty much are the gold standard for things like world rankings of universities. They're perceived by many as having an inferior quality as a consequence of that. There are a few exceptions, like the Public Library of Science journals, which have an extraordinary journal impact factor, but they're more the exception than the rule. And the other thing about open access is, if we talk about the gold model, someone's still paying. It may not be the subscription-based model, but someone else is paying, and often it's now the author. There are many flavours of open access. Gavin actually touched on all of these for you, but many people actually aren't that clear on the difference between the types of open access, including the outgoing CEO from the ARC, Margaret Scheel, who managed to conflate gold with green, unfortunately, and put our cause back by quite a large step. Green open access, as Gavin explained, refers to institutional repository deposit. I like to think of it as what we can do for works that aren't born open access. So what we're doing is making the most of the rights that researchers have retained in their work without the need to necessarily topple existing traditional publishing models. I think the reason that repositories have so much support is that they're something we can do right now without having to change everything that's already in place. To give you a brief insight into how we manage our repository at Swinburne, as opposed to the models that Gavin's presented from QUT, Griffith and Deakin, we have a different approach to many. Some have the same model, others don't. We like to see that the institutional repository in itself isn't a service, it's a piece of technology, and the service is how we use it. So, we actually deposit on behalf of the authors, so what we do is we go and collect as much information as we can about works that have been published by Swinburne authors, and then we follow up the full text if required. So we do it for them instead of asking anyone to key in metadata. We are able to collect once and push out to many places, so we actually collect all the information at Swinburne for use in research reporting for the annual HERTSI and for ERA. So that does make that exception where you had to report your publications to more than one place. We don't have particularly strong views on what should be in a repository. We like to think that we collect everything that a researcher might want associated with their research profile. So in physics, this is probably peer-reviewed journal articles, but in the social sciences, sometimes the impact of the research on, say, policy or in something like The Conversation is just as significant. We have a preference for the published version over the accepted manuscript because our researchers asked for it. Because it's kind of viewed as the gold standard of the publishing. And the essence of what we do is to save researchers time and essentially bring them fame and fortune and all those things that doesn't actually happen in academia. Open access we see as the bonus, not the essence of the repository. So what we see as the benefit is a complete list of all of their publications in one place. And that means we do have a lot of metadata-only records. And about 30% full text, but we are working to lift that full text process. Those lists of publications are used in dynamic places around the website, so we do see some value in doing that. Gold is different. Gold is where research is published in openly accessible journals that cover their costs by charging a fee for publication. or not in some cases. So a lot of libraries run open access journals without charging anyone, out of the goodness of our hearts as usual. With some open access journals, the labour is volunteered by academics as part of what they believe to be their contribution to scholarly research. At Swinburne Library, we currently have three open access journals that we publish with varying models. We really only ever charge to cover our costs with one journal, and because it doesn't have a heavy Swinburne involvement. With the ones that do, we don't charge anything at all. There is this extra category now that Gavin mentioned, hybrid journals. So this is when a subscription journal, say something published by Elsevier, Springer, one of the big publishers, allows authors to make an individual article openly accessible for a fee, and it's often quite a high one. The obvious benefit of this, which is slightly controversial to say as a librarian, because we're not meant to be pro this, is that researchers supported by a research funder with a mandate, this means they can still publish in the journals of their choice. They don't have to decide to publish in a different journal because it'll fit the mandate. So they can continue to publish in the top journals in their field. They've just got to pay for it, and they've got to pay a lot. That's the one real downside. Unfortunately, the figures I'm showing you right now are a few years old, but I haven't been able to find a more recent study at the moment. Might have to do it myself if I want to. You know how it is. I doubt that things have changed a lot since 2009, except perhaps for the increase in the number of hybrid journals, like I mentioned. But what this diagram essentially shows you is that we have in the past needed both gold and green open access to reach our goals, and I think that might continue. The differences in disciplines are notable here. So we have medicine with a lot of gold open access and not much green, and physics and astronomy at the bottom with a lot of green open access and not much gold. And there's clear reasons for this. So things like the National Institute of Health mandate in the US and the UK's Wellcome Trust have been around for a while, and they support public access to medical research. So a lot of the medical journals publish born open access, so they don't need green. Whereas in physics and astronomy, and you can probably count computer science in this category as well because they're not separately listed, there's a long-held tradition of putting your papers online. So with physics and astronomy, it's in the archive subject repository, which has been around for 20-odd years. And with computer scientists, it's usually in departmental websites. So they have a long history of green and therefore haven't really required much in the way of gold. But if you were to add together the amount in each of these categories, you find that overall, open access to scientific literature is still quite low, barely 30%, and that's the top. So we have to assume this is part of the reason for the UK's point. So the Finch report is actually, in its full title, Accessibility, Sustainability, Excellence, How to Expand Access to Research Publications, Report of the Working Group on Expanding Access to Published Research Findings, the Finch Group, which is run by Dame Finch. The group's remit, according to their report, was to examine how to expand access to the peer-reviewed publications that arise from research undertaken both in the UK and in the rest of the world, and to propose a programme of action to that end. So what the Finch report recommends for the UK, yes, it does mean that the UK is putting their research online and no one's doing the same thing, but they are intending the rest of us to follow their model. I'm going to take you through some of the Finch report recommendations and what they might mean for the groups concerned. For researchers, probably the main recommendations that I'd want to highlight from the Finch report are publications should be funded by article processing charges, so that's the gold open access model. Universities should establish funds to pay for these. There's a clear preference in the report for researchers publishing in open access journals or a hybrid model. Some universities, they assume, will move towards open access as the default model of publishing. I think that might depend on your discipline, but so the things I've picked out that I think researchers need to be aware of with this, and you might want to talk to them about it if they come to you about this report, the main issues are cost and impact. So So I think the question for all of this is, where is the money going to come from for these article processing fees? And if it's going to come out of the research pool, what else does it affect? Does it affect the researchers' ability to publish as regularly as they have? Does it affect their chances of having a PhD student or postdoc to work on their project? The other issue is impact. So if we assume for the moment that the Finch model will only work in the UK, what's their CV going to look like outside the UK if they're publishing fewer articles in not necessarily the top journals in their field? I'd also like to bring up the point about I've always been able to pay to have my work published, but isn't that a bad thing? Because that's one I think you might get as well. Vanity publishing is rife, but in the past, if you wanted to self-publish your book, you probably didn't have to pay as much as it's suggesting that you'll have to pay for your journal article. Peter McCauley said in the Research Whisperer just a few days ago that you should publish where the audience, i.e. the readers, will benefit the most, and that is a strong support for the hybrid model. But hybrid publishing has potential, but it's just so expensive. Finch also has something to say to us as librarians. The group thinks that institutional repositories should be relegated to a preservation role and only for grey literature, theses and data, stuff that supports the scholarly publishing industry, but not stuff that replaces it. So repositories would become complementary, storing all of the material that wasn't yet published or won't be published. What this means is no more green open access. So what librarians need to think about is, are we happy with this? Do we have an opinion? I think we should. Not only because it might cost us our jobs. I'm quoting here the Bell, Fried, Foster and Gibbons in 2005 talking about the beginning of the institutional repository movement, those awkward first steps. What they saw as the future of repositories was a showcase for the scholarly output of faculty, which I think we've done a great job of doing, a relatively inexpensive means for disseminating faculty research results. That's questionable. If the self-deposit model worked alone, then it would be relatively inexpensive, but if it doesn't, then you are investing librarian time as well. As for the possible tool to leverage journal prices downward, that definitely didn't happen. What I think we have to think about is what is important to us. Is it institutional repositories per se, or is it supporting scholarly publication in a broader sense? With repositories, we've designed them to save researchers time and make them famous. Will we still be able to promise that if all that we're collecting is the material that they haven't published and maybe never will? What kind of service are we really offering? Finch's recommendations for funders are that they'll need to support the changes that happen. They've said that an embargo on the content of scholarly publishing of less than 12 months is unreasonable. And they also said don't rule out diversion of funds from support of other features of the research process. So here's the kicker, that publication might happen at the expense of research. As both a taxpayer and an open access advocate, I've got a problem with that. Funders have a few things they'll have to think about if they have to follow this UK Finch model. How are they going to deal with article processing charges being split across institutions or even countries? How are they going to manage this question of what's reasonable in an embargo period? Whether researchers are going to find compliance extremely difficult with these mandates and decide not to apply for their funding? Whether, as in Belgium, they'll only fund researchers with open access publications in their CVs? And whether all funder policies should look alike, or whether we should be factoring in differences between disciplines. For the government, they're looking at stumping up an additional £50 to £60 million each year while open access gets started. £38 million of this has been set aside for article processing alone. That's a lot of money, especially for a region that isn't doing quite as well as it has in the past. So what the UK government's going to have to think about, and the rest of us if this sort of model goes past the UK, is how taxpayers are going to feel about funding publication and not research. Would they prefer that the authors have a publication, or would they prefer that someone's curing cancer? How are governments going to measure research activity and quality? Because all of our current quality assessments are similar, and they're based on the traditional citation impact models in traditional scholarly journals. And I think the government is going to have to be very clear on how good or extensive research is if they're going to have to, if taxpayers are going to have to pay quite so much for it. And I've done a little calculation, and I'm not a mathematician, so forgive me if this is totally incorrect. But if Finch has allowed $38 million per annum for pays charges, the UK government last week committed £10 million. here's the current status for how much it costs to publish in a hybrid journal in the major publishers. Springer, Wiley, Sage, all the same cost. Taylor and Francis, slightly different. It's not an exact figure because they charge differently in the US and UK, which is why my translation doesn't look quite right there. Elsevier, same, except for Lancet, where you have to pay £400 every time you want to publish a page. So your article had better be, I cured cancer, not here's how I cured cancer. Admittedly, this is the worst case scenario, because this would require all UK researchers to have to publish everything in hybrid journals, whereas they won't always be having to do that. Sometimes they'll publish in cheaper open access journals or free ones. But if all UK researchers were to follow this model, £10 million isn't going to go very far, neither is £38 million, when the annual UK research output is 60,000 publications. Now for some good news, because I can't end on a negative note. Australia is a bit different from the UK, so our repositories are quite embedded here. The government supported a lot, sent us a lot of money to support reporting exercises like ERA. Yes, that's a dark process, not an open process, so most people are having to hide that material, but it does mean that the repositories stand as something important in government's eyes. Many of us also support HERTSI to varying levels, not everyone, but we do. So that means we're embedded in the process of research reporting. The NHMRC established its first mandate, effective on the 1st of July. And the mandate is quite flexible in terms of mandates, if you can actually say that, I'm not sure. But it's almost in opposition to Finch. So what the NHMRC requires is that after 12 months, you deposit your publication in your institutional repository unless prevented by legal or contractual obligations. So that's accessible or practical, depending on which way you look at it. Despite Finch, repositories in Australia are clearly still going strong because we have a lot of a role here. And it might just help us to reposition our repositories for this new role. If the NHMRC has established this mandate, that makes us an important part of the system. The ARC is still consulting. It's been clear that the new CEO has a different perspective from the old CEO, which is a relief to all of us, I think. Open Access Week is coming up in a few weeks, and I'd like you to think about asking not what open access can do for you, but what you can do for open access. I guarantee, as a repository manager, that if you ask your repository manager, there is something that you can help with. There's marketing and promotion, there's getting presentations at faculty meetings, copyright policy checking, record enrichment, all kinds of things that needs to be done. You might even want to use it as an opportunity to go out into your faculty groups and try to drum up some open access copies of things. Other universities have done that in the past. For Swinburne, we found the best way to engage our researchers in the repository is to show clear benefits for them, saving time on administrative tasks while promoting their work at the same time. And we don't think of ourselves as working for global open access, but working for our researchers, and where open access helps, we use it. And open access has provided an opportunity for us. So what better time to get involved than for Open Access Week? Thank you.